Hello, everyone. This is Leslie, and my Dungeons and Dragons class is mage, I think, and I'm chaotic good. And that's all. What are you, Mark?
I mean, most boring response considering it's the same as you, but I'd
Oh,
say generally I'm
you're
also a
amazing.
mage and I'm also chaotic good, but I guess if I'm going slightly different, I'll be a I quite like being a thief on occasion.
Oh yeah, a tea leaf. It's Raven slang for thief, in
That
case you
is.
don't know.
And
I don't
like, I
think
don't
that's
know,
part of
I'll
the.
be a chaotic neutral thief.
Right, see, this is the thing, right? We're talking about Dungeons and Dragons, but and specifically to do with Stranger Things, which was on the list last week. Hi, welcome to Crystal Myth, by the way. I mean, if you don't
Yo,
know by now, then what are you doing? I guess why are you starting with this episode? Go back to the beginning and listen to, from the beginning of our episodes. From the beginning all the way to now. Oh, okay. Apart from like our
See you in a
loyal
few
listeners.
hours. Bye.
Hi. Right, so we're talking about Dungeons and Dragons, which was a game invented by a couple of guys. I don't know whether they were American or what, in the 70s, early 70s, late 70s. Fuck knows. I've got the
Late
information
70s,
here.
I think.
There's one of the guys got a really weird name. Gary something. Guy Gex? No. Yeah, we got it right here.
It was Gary Busey.
No, it was not. Bussy. Is that not a word for a man's? You know, instead of pussy, you say boot,
Yes.
but it's Busey, not Boosie.
Oh, sorry, Gary Busey.
Gary
I mean,
Busey.
Busey and Boosie are
Gary.
basically the same word.
Gary Busey's big Boosie. That could be like a new show for him or something.
A new Saturday night quiz show.
He could sell his show. No, I mean, he could sell his Boosie to the highest bidder, you know? I don't imagine his Boosie's been penetrated. Why am I talking about this? This is bad. Wait, I was just like, Gary Gygax. I think that's how you pronounce it. Is it Gygax or Gygax? I'm going to say Gygax. I mean, that's such a strange name.
As it
I
sounds
like.
like he is a Dungeons and Dragons
It
character.
does. Yeah, so it was designed, created by Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, and it was first published in 1974 by Tactical Studies Rules. It's also been published by Wizards of the Coast, later a subsidiary of Hasbro since 1997. And it was derived from miniature war games with a variation on the 1971 game Chainmail, serving as the initial rule system. D&D's publication is commonly recognized as the beginning of modern role-playing games and the role-playing game industry, and it has also deeply influenced video games, especially the role-playing video game. So it is the origin of all of that shit. And
Is
as I was saying, like there was where we were talking about like chaotic good and neutral and all this shit. I didn't realize that that was from Dungeons and Dragons until just there, because
yeah.
I see all these memes and it says like you know list these people into like neutral evil, chaotic evil, and all this stuff, and I'm like, what does that even? Where's that come from? And that's where it comes from. Did
Indeed.
you? Obviously, you knew that.
Well, I knew it was
Oh,
in
you're a player.
Dungeons and Dragons. I'd never really thought about whether or not it came from Dungeons and Dragons,
Oh.
but I knew that it was a feature of Dungeons and Dragons.
Right. And then you've got your like, because I was saying my class system is a mage, and there's various class systems that you like. See, when you make up a character in Dungeons and Dragons that as part of your party, but you can only play good characters, can't you? You can't just say, "Oh, I'm an evil bastard."
I think for the most part, but there's lots of expansion packs that are like really specific. Like I know there's a gay expansion pack that was
What?
made for Pride 1 year. So it's like,
Shouldn't laugh.
yeah, so it's got like characters that you haven't been able to play before with like their playable stats, and then it's got areas to visit, like it's got a sort of medieval gay nightclub.
Right, so I'd imagine a lot of original D&D players might not be too happy with that, but then I don't know, would they? Like, I thought that it was inclusive to everybody anyway, Dungeons and Dragons, so why would you need a gay edition?
You could already, your character could be gay. It's just the expansion. Like, it didn't add being able to be a gay character, but it added characters that weren't playable before. So there must be some expansion packs that have, like, bad guys that are playable. Plus, if you play as the Dungeon Master, then technically you kind of are all the characters. So you get to play as evil characters, which is fun.
Yeah, because the Dungeon Master, I was reading, basically plays all the NPCs as in non-playable characters, which I know from video games is like, because you're not playing that character, but technically the Dungeon Master is playing them.
Yeah.
Weird. So he gets to do all the sort of non-canon, like non-participating in the actual game characters. He makes up the story. You can either follow the actual rule book or the story in the book, or he can make up his own storyline, which is nice.
Yeah, like whenever you get a pack, you get maps and stuff with it, but if you want the game to go on, like if you're the DM, you can make up your own maps, and like obviously the maps are supposed to span entire continents and things, so it'll just show you like a small area of it, and there'll be like paths and rivers and things leaning like off the edges of the map, so you can expand on it yourself as well if you want.
But it even said like you can make up your own rules aside from the rules in the rule book, which I'm like, well, what is the point of the rule book then? Or what if you're a bit of an arsehole and you don't like certain someone in the group, so you make it so that, you know, they can't win as a Dungeon Master?
But then I think it's generally like good etiquette that the like party that play with you would like sign off on any new rules that you're introducing.
So explain to me how the dice works, because see, when it said you had to do like maths, that just completely turned me off the game. I was like, well, I don't, fuck that, I'm not doing mathematics.
No, I'm not a fan of maths either.
I'm a fan of pretending to blast people with like mage powers and everything, but then you've got to like throw it. The dice system looks really complicated.
I think it depends, like you can sort of, again, depending on who the Dungeon Master is, like alter how many you use as well, because the original version of the game, like the actual battle, different hit points for different moves and different types of attacks, and how much you get injured and how much the like non-playable character gets injured are all dependent on rolls of the different dice, and it'll tell you which combination of dice to use for each move, but realistically you can like streamline it.
Right, and also it's not just battles that the dice determines, it also determines how you can unpick lock and what determines that, or how powerful you are, or how strong you are lifting up
how well the spell works. Even, like, you'll do things where if you're, like, playing through one of the packs, it'll be, like, you open a cellar door and you realise that it's full of whatever, like, zombies, snakes. And then you roll the dice to see how many zombies or snakes or whatever there are in there. Yeah.
Okay. And then, so what happens then? Is it the Dungeon Master that determines the storyline at all times, or do the characters get to say, right, well, I'm now going to fight this one-eyed monster,
Like, the Dungeon Master designs what happens in each bit of the map, but the players get to decide, like, where they go on the map, which paths they follow, whether or not they follow a path or go off the path. Like, yeah, you can make your own decisions, so it's like turn-based, but they, like, you, me, and I don't know, and Charlotte and John were playing and someone else was the Dungeon Master. If like I was first, then I'd be like, oh, I'm going to, I don't know, fight the bugbear. And then if it was your turn, you could choose whether to join me in fighting the bugbear or try to cast a spell. Or, I mean, in theory, you could be like, I'm going to go look behind this tree, or I have a teapot in my bag of holding, I'm going to put it on my head. And then it would be Charlotte's go and you'd have a teapot on your head.
Right, so everyone needs to pay attention to what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
And does everyone get a turn of rolling the dice? Is that what happens? Or does the Dungeon Master just roll the dice for everybody?
It's turn-based, but then whatever you decide you're going to do, that might elicit a response, either according to... Like, you can get game packs you play through, which will give the Dungeon Master things to do in specific circumstances. So it might randomly say, like, if a player at some point in the game puts a teapot on their head, like, that X happens, like, they summon a djinn. But right. then it's still turn-based, so even then, if you summoned the djinn, it would still then be Charlotte's turn. And then when it got back to you, you would then roll the dice for like how powerful your djinn's attack was on the bugbear. Or
but who decides
if you tried to get the djinn to grant a wish, you might roll like a six-pointed dice, and then if it was an odd number, your wish would be granted, and if it was an even number, it wouldn't.
Right, and you decide that as a dungeon master based on the rulebook.
Yeah, if there's nothing in the rulebook to
determine the outcome,
determine what the response is to a specific action, then the dungeon master effectively makes it up.
Right, but then again, how do you do that fairly? Because you could go, well, I just make out that I don't want this person to succeed, so fuck them. I'll just make out that by rolling the dice. And
but again, it has to seem reasonable. So
right, okay.
It turned out that it said you summon a djinn, but then there was no rules for what happens when you summon the djinn if the dungeon master was like, roll the 20 pointed dice. If it's between like 1 and 10, it grants your wish. And if it's between like 11 and 20, it curses you. That would be fine. But if they were like, if you roll a 1, it grants your wish. And if you roll a 2 to 20, then it curses you. Then you'd be like, nah.
Can the players decide that the dungeon master is shite and overthrow him or her?
Yeah, I think like people will quite often, or not quite often, but people will sometimes abandon a dungeon master. Not like mid-game, but you might stop playing with a dungeon master and then play with another dungeon master, or like appoint somebody else in your group the dungeon master if someone's particularly shit at it.
What's better, being the dungeon master? I feel like this is just an interview with me, like Mark, who's played this game before and I've not. What's better, being the dungeon master or being a character?
And I like both.
Right, okay. And how long do these games go on for? Is it like Monopoly, but it can go on forever?
I mean, it could go on for years.
How does it actually end? Is there ever a winner?
No, because in theory you could end a mission, so you could go on like a specific mission and then be like, oh, you've saved the prince and won a golden chariot. And then you go into the gay bar with the prince. yeah, and that would be like the end of that mission, but you can still in theory keep playing the game. If you decided to play like an hour long session and you were finishing off a previous game and you finished 15 minutes in, you could be like, okay, we're all going to get in a raft and sail down the river and see where that goes. And then
what if
the dungeon master has to make up what happens depending on where you get off the raft, unless there's a like pre-created map for it.
What if like I'm playing and I lose all my experience points or something and I die? Am I out of the game then, or do I just have to watch? Or can I rejoin or I'm talking about video game speak here, respawn, so to speak? And
it depends. So you
can you imagine
might
back
just
to
have
life?
To watch, but you could also in theory like respawn, as you say, if if there was some like way for a magic user in your group to do that, or somebody had a specific spell or talisman or something, or you could just like make up a new character
that they could then meet
in the next mission. So you could be like, oh, Leslie fell off the back of the raft and died. But then when you pull up in a new town, you could be like, oh, you're in a new town like inhabited entirely by elves, and you could be like, right, now I'm an elf character. So
all right, well then, that's a good introduction to the world of Dungeons and Dragons. I suppose my first knowledge of Dungeons and Dragons was the cartoon in the 80s, where I don't know if that's got anything to do with the game, but
yeah, it's based on the game as well.
But how?
Because they're all, every one of the characters, when they go into the land of Dungeons and Dragons, the like new body they inhabit is one of the main classes.
Who's the baddie in it? Is it Vecnar?
Is it, or is it the Necromancer? Google it. I think the baddie might be the Necromancer.
Obviously, it can't be as scary as it is in the real game, because also, like, I want to point out that we've covered this in a previous episode. It's part of the Satanic Panic era, whereby, because Dungeons & Dragons quite popular in the 80s, a lot of Christians in a mostly in America, where like, oh, you can't play this game because there's demons in it and there's women with their tits out and stuff. So therefore, it's evil and bad and you shouldn't play it. It's a devil's game. Whereas it's harmless. It's just a bunch of kids rolling a dice. Like, I don't know if there's been any people who've actually been so influenced by Dungeons and Dragons that they've went out and killed someone. There probably will be some point.
I don't think there have. I think, like, as you say, there's been murders and things like that linked to Dungeons and Dragons, but not for any reason other than that some random, like, right-wing Christian in America was like, "Then I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons." Wenger.
Yeah, I knew it was a V.
The Shadow Demon is the other. They're the two main antagonists of the series. Oh, and Tiamat, which is the dragon with the five heads. That's each of its heads is a different type of dragon.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, now that I've looked that up, that is it. So when they go into the world of Dungeons and Dragons, the one of the kids becomes a magician, one becomes an acrobat warrior, one becomes a ranger, one becomes a thief, one becomes a cavalier, and one becomes a barbarian, and they're your six main.
So classes. which is the lamest character to have? Is it a wizard? Is it a healer? I don't know if that's one of the categories.
I'd say a cavalier, because that's basically just like a posh knight, so you can't be any of the cool races. You're basically just like
a man.
Yeah, you're like a white man.
A white man. The worst thing you can be in it, of course.
And you're probably heterosexual.
Right. So going into like looking into the moral panic of it, as we said before, the satanic panic thing, they were like, oh, Dungeons and Dragons promotes devil worshiping and witchcraft, suicide and murder. And this is what I read, like, so they said that there was the presence of naked breasts and drawings of female humanoids in the original AD&D manuals. I guess that's a more advanced Dungeons and Dragons. Advanced Dungeons and Dragons manuals. But mainly the breasts or the big milkers were put on monsters such as harpies and succubi. So
yeah, I was just thinking, I can't think of a single Dungeons and Dragons guide that I've seen where there's been any boobs, but you're right. That,
because they protested and then they changed when the third edition came out. They basically didn't give them big titties anymore.
But also, harpies are traditionally topless, and I'm not being funny. Like, not who's having a wank over harpies. Maybe some people are into that, but I feel like that's pretty niche. Like,
exactly. Do you know what makes me think these Christians are the ones that are getting horny over these big titty bird things?
Yeah, there's some minister, like repressed minister's wife somewhere going like... like overwhelmed with the vapors seeing a harpy.
Also, when I was talking about, has it influenced people, like, as they say, like, to be demonic or go on to do evil things, it's been the subject of rumors, I don't know if it's true, regarding players having difficulty separating fantasy from reality, even leading to psychotic episodes. But I don't see how you could, because it's basically a tabletop game. I mean, I would say that maybe using a virtual reality headset might do that to you. Maybe I'm just being too loud.
I don't think that's...
Like, it's saying that using your imagination is a bad thing, and that if you use it too much, then you won't... How can you not know that you're not in reality? What?
I just sent you a picture, by the way, of the current handbook's picture of a harpy, because she's still naked and she still has her tits out.
Titties out, let me see. Sorry, listeners, someone offers me a picture of some titties. Yeah, but you can't see the nipples.
You can't see the nipples, that is true.
I guess that's the crucial part, that they're not flopping about. Maybe in the earlier ones, they were completely out there. Because that, to me, that could be a bum if you, you know, look at it close up. It could just be an arse.
So, I like the idea that she has an arse on her
An arse on her chest.
I mean, she's a monster, so why not?
Yeah, why not? I mean, you could just say that, yeah. The monster that has an arse for a head. I suppose, like, the demigorgons kind of look like they've got arses for heads and Stranger Things. You know how, because they open up like an arsehole?
Yeah.
Wow, had to go there, didn't I?
So you can also get, if you have, like, a massive map and you can play it as, like, a proper, like, non-moving tabletop, you can get, like, the figurines of the different creatures to put in the different rooms of the dungeon. And then you can obviously like cover them up if you don't want them to know that they're there, and then do a dramatic reveal. But they, I'm just going to send you, so the current harpy figurine does have her boobs out properly.
Oh, yes, like, have you got a picture?
Yeah, just sending you.
Oh, yeah. Ah, they're nice.
She's also got like a very cool punk aesthetic.
She does, actually.
Like, to be fair, after me being like, that's a niche fetish, I'm like, no, she is quite hot.
She doesn't have any genital. Oh, I guess she's wearing some sort of thong, because you can kind of see it there. So
yeah, you can make
it like that. She hasn't got her push out, but she's got her tits.
No, she's got like a little, like, thongy cut short things on.
Yeah, hi.
She's got a bit of the Grace Jones about her.
She does look like Grace Jones, yeah. I mean, I assume this is a figurine that's not meant to be all grey, that she's meant to be painted. Because I would want
to become all grey, but you can get special paints for them so that you can, like, the dungeon master can paint them however they want them to specifically appear. But they normally do just come grey.
So it says, come grey. Harpy, medium monstrosity, chaotic evil. I don't know what's the difference between neutral evil, chaotic evil, and just plain old evil. I don't know.
Everything's lawful, neutral.
Lawful, neutral, chaotic. Is that it? Right. Yeah. So the lawful ones are the ones that just follow the rules all the time.
Yep.
And the chaotic ones, I'm guessing, are rogues. A little bit whoa kind of thing. And neutral are just like sit on the fence, kind of. They could go either way.
Like, a neutral good is always good. A chaotic good is always good, but you. So if you're a good, so a chaotic good is always good, but you could bring harm to others because you don't think out your actions.
Right.
And a lawful good isn't necessarily actually always good. Because, like, if you worked for Big Charlie Fingers just now and followed all the rules that he set, you would technically be lawful good because you're doing it for the good of the realm, old chap, and all that. And those,
but it's not necessarily good for the people themselves. You think you're doing good for the good of the realm. Like, if you're a Tory, basically.
Yeah.
You think you're doing the good things, but actually you're just a complete bastard that's greedy and all out for themselves. Can you get...
Then you also get, like, lawful evil. So, like, lawful evil would be... like, most of the police are...
corrupt bastard,
Well, no, I'm thinking most of the police are probably lawful.
The royal family?
Good, because they think they're doing it for a good reason, even if it's bringing harm to others.
Right.
But some of the police will be lawful evil, where they always follow the rules specifically because it brings harm to others.
Right, okay. Okay. So what would O.J. Simpson be?
Chaotic evil?
Yeah, that'd be more fun at the same time.
Yeah, he's definitely chaotic evil.
Chaotic evil, yeah, okay. Well, there was, I'm trying to think, was there any murders to do with Dungeons & Dragons? It says there was... Nah, there isn't really, I don't think. It says a game was blamed for some of the actions of Chris Pritchard, who was convicted in 1990 of murdering his stepfather. Research by various psychologists, starting with Armando Simon, has concluded that no harmful effects are related to the playing of Dungeons & Dragons, and it's also been cited as encouraging people to socialise weekly or bi-weekly, teaching problem-solving skills which can be beneficial in adult life, and teaching positive moral decisions. So I think the whole Chris Pritchard thing is a lot of shite. Maybe he played Dungeons & Dragons once, but I don't think that's the reason why he killed his stepfather.
No.
And they've got a point, like, because people don't generally socialise much anymore, and I guess they associate Dungeons & Dragons with a bunch of nerds and stuff, like, oh god, what are they doing, or why are you adults playing Dungeons & Dragons? Because it's mostly, I don't think a lot of kids play it, it's mostly, like, adults, isn't it?
I think nowadays, I think when it first came out, it was, like, mostly teenagers that played it, but I think now it's mostly, like...
Adults have their own groups. Yeah. Yeah, or they might stream it. In fact, there's a YouTuber I follow called Moist Critical, or Charlie White, and he started his own Dungeons & Dragons YouTube channel. with his own group or his own team of players. And he said he'd never played it before, but he's even got like his own animations and stuff for it. So I guess maybe it's still quite popular. And I know a guy I worked with who's in these same age as me, nearly 40, and he regularly meets up with people and plays Dungeons and Dragons. So I suppose it's like a bunch of guys just meeting up to play poker. It's just a different version of that, and you get to tag out your mates. Like, so Stranger Things,
which is like again, more creative. Like although I like playing, uh-huh. I do quite like DMing because it is fun because you're effectively writing a story.
Right.
Like a story in a pre-existing universe. So it's like fanfic almost.
What was
you're
the last
writing, like fanfic that people respond to and you don't know what's going to happen, which is fun.
What was the last story that you did in Dungeons and Dragons?
What was the last story that I did in Dungeons and Dragons? That one of the like mayor folk, mayor lords, daughters was missing, and
yeah, what was the mission?
They had to rescue her and then basically get her back safely, and then it turned out that there was like a baby bugbear.
All right, I don't know what
that
was.
It was also being held with her, so they had to take that and protect it so that the evil lords in the ice castle, who are effectively just Tories, could get access to it and turn it on the people.
All right, okay. And that was how that ended then?
It never really ends. Again, it never really ends.
What's a bugbear?
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't do bugbears, because I'm slightly obsessed with them.
Yeah, but they're not in Stranger Things, so you can't.
Well, I've done stuff that's not in Stranger Things, although it is tenuously related to Stranger Things. Bugbears aren't at all, to be fair. And wouldn't really fit in with the aesthetic of
I'm imagining them to be a cross between a bear and a bug, because I'm just that literal.
They're like, kind of that.
But isn't a bugbear like a turn of phrase? Like, oh, you've got a bugbear against...
Yeah, it's like the thing that annoys you. Hold on, I'm going to send you an image of
it. Is there an actual picture? Yeah, but this isn't helping the listeners because they can't see what you're sending.
Well, I'll send it and you describe it.
I'd love to see the tip, but yeah, okay. Right, well, we still haven't even gotten into Stranger Things.
we haven't, but we did say that lots of things are inspired by Dungeons and Dragons, and this is included. Then I'll send you a picture of a bugbear.
Please. Is it a bugbear with massive tits? Right, okay. He's offering me a little cup of tea.
But then they're very like, so...
Oh, they're quite big.
They're really big, and then if they're like basically trained to be feral, it's effectively like a wolf and a dog.
It does look like a cross between a wolf and a dog.
So they're like meant to be intelligent, but if you don't train them up properly, or if you train them up, they're like they go around and terrify villages and things because they're so big and they're feral. But then
that
if you
one's
get
giving
one,
you a nice cup of tea.
Yeah.
Or should I drink it? Because what if it's poison? You don't know whether it's offering you a lovely cup of tea or a lovely cup of tea laced with arsenic or something.
Oh, also linking in
for
your earlier question. So as of the 27th of February 2023, an expansion pack has been released where players who wish to can play as a bugbear.
Oh, okay. So what is that then? Chaotic goods?
Let's find out. It is.
How many?
So if you play Bugbear, if you have Bugbear in as a monster, it's one of the ones that have been trained to be evil. So it's chaotic evil.
Mm.
They're either chaotic, they're always chaotic. You can get ones that are chaotic evil, chaotic neutral, or chaotic good.
Yep. Okay. Well, I'd like to play one of them.
I think you'd make a wonderful Bugbear.
Thank you. In Stranger Things, there's a group of young lads and they play Dungeons and Dragons because it's the 80s and apparently that's what, like, little wee guys, tweens from that era do. And the one of them's wee sister, I think there was like the token black guy in it, is got a wee sister, and she's like amazing at Dungeons and Dragons, but she's not really allowed to play with them. But occasionally she does, and she's like, probably because she's better than everyone else and she's really smart. But she acts all cool and stuff, like that she doesn't actually want to play it, but then she is actually really good. What's her name? Let me find out.
I want to call her Erica. Is her name Erica?
No, she is yeah, it is Erica. You're right. Yay. Claire. So it was a website called Nerdist, and they've given all the characters of Stranger Things their categories or class in Dungeons and Dragons, and they've gave her the rogue. And she's called Lady Applejack, because that's her character, and she's a level 14 chaotic good half-elf rogue, and she's one of the coolest in the universe and D&D characters. Her passion for D&D surprises everyone, and her canon choice as a rogue makes a lot of sense for her in the show too, because she's resourceful, independent, and versatile, and which are all good tenets of a great rogue, apparently. And she's not afraid to do what needs to be done. Usually the smartest person in the room, and the party's lucky to have her. And hopefully season 5 will see her greatly expand her role. So there you go.
Cool.
Yeah.
I've never played as a rogue though, but I don't think I'm very rogue-like.
They made one up for, what's his face? Steve. They made a category up for him, a class for him, and they called him the babysitter. because of his leadership and righteousness of a paladin. What is a paladin?
Is a paladin,
well, I don't like, know, I'm asking you.
Somebody, a paladin is a character that supports a knight, I think, or supports a cavalier. Hold on, I'm going to check.
You're the dungeon master, mate. You should know this.
Yeah, but you only have to know what the characters of the people that are playing in your game are.
See, I've only heard of a paladin as in, like, again, computer games from World of Warcraft, and I think they're pandas. But again, oh, does that
sorry, so a paladin is like a cavalier, right. But it's basically, it's not what I was saying a cavalier was, what right. I was saying that you work for. So a paladin is a good knight. They crusade rather in the name of a king or queen, in the name of good and order.
Ah, okay, so he's a lawful good.
So yes.
They're saying
you can only have a lawful good alignment.
Steve's character has the righteousness of paladin with the inspirational powers of a cleric sprinkled with that Steve magic. His love for the kids of Hawkins doesn't make him a pedo, it just makes him stand apart, and has lately saved the world multiple times. The responsibilities he takes on and respect for Nancy's boundaries shows in one of the seasons that make him a unique pseudo-parental figure in the realm of Hawkins. So, yeah, I guess that's true. Because he was a bit of a bastard at first, but then he becomes sort of like, he befriends or becomes a mentor to one of the kids and kind of looks after them.
Yeah, and then becomes like a better person through it.
Yeah, one of the classes is Bard. So that would be Eddie Munson as a Bard.
Yes.
Which is obvious. And Robin Buckley is a Bard as well. Well, according to this, they've deemed her a bard because she's a musician at heart and she's always been true to herself and used her words for good. These qualities make her a great bard. Although she didn't get to truly shine in Stranger Things 4, we're hoping that we get to explore more of her musical prowess and hopefully her personal life in next season, especially after where we leave her. I can't remember what happened to her.
I would just put her as a mage because basically because I think she's quite cool and she's queer. And I feel like queer category is mage.
So you're saying that all queers are mages?
No, but I'm saying that all mages should be queer.
Queer, right, okay.
Otherwise you're not a good mage.
Right. Well, Nancy...
Mages have like big bisexual energy.
Yeah. But she's a total, like, she's not bisexual, she's lesbian, isn't she?
That's true.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was surprised that... Bard myself, I didn't really get that, but okay.
No, she doesn't read Bard to me.
Nancy Wheeler, who's Steven's ex, is a fighter class. Is that a class? Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I would say like a cavalier's a fighter, a ranger's a fighter, a barbarian's a fighter.
Here's another one, Max Mayfield, right? She is a speedster. Now, in Stranger Things 3, Max suggested that she be a Zoomer. A Zoomer to us is something altogether different. But anyway, in the group's D&D campaign, that was met with derision as it wasn't a class. So a Zoomer isn't a class. A Zoomer to me is someone who's a bit of an idiot.
Yeah, like an absolute Zoomer.
Yeah, absolute Zoomer. There is actually a D&D homebrew speedster class. And Stranger Things Max fits it pretty well because she travels on her skateboard, she rightfully points out. But the most memorable moment she has in one of the seasons is her running from Vecna's curse. We'll talk about Vecna shortly. Max is speedy, sometimes dangerously so, and she can use it to her advantage. Okay. So, we've gone over Erica. Then... obviously, Eleven's a mage because she's got actual magic powers. So.
Fair.
Then we've got Dustin, who is an artificer, master inventor. But he was originally the group's bard, but over the seasons, he's become their inventor. What do you think of that? Well, he does invent shit. Will Byers, he's a wizard.
Yeah.
Because he was in the show.
Because he's queer.
Yeah, he is actually queer, isn't he? I don't know if
he's
officially as gay in the show yet. No, he hasn't. He's not out of the closet, but it's implied.
Yeah.
Well, therefore, he should be a mage then, shouldn't he? Not a wizard.
But wizards and mages are close enough.
Are they? Right. Then
I'd say wizards. Wizards are like straight mages.
Okay. Lucas Sinclair, which is Erica's brother, he is a ranger.
He is a ranger. I agree with that one.
Hunter Conclave. And then Paladin is Mike Wheeler or Finn Wolfhard. He's a Paladin because he supports Eleven and stuff, I guess. Well, there you go. That's what someone decided to class the main characters of Stranger Things as. So, like, what, right, one of the main creatures, we're looking at creatures that inspired the Stranger Things lore or whatever, because they play Dungeons and Dragons, they don't know the names of these creatures that come out through the Upside Down, so they only compare them to monsters that they know from D&D. So one of them is the Demogorgon, which I was going to look at, what I looked at, and what was the one that you were looking at?
Mindflayer? I looked at the Mind Flayer.
Yeah.
And then I looked at, well, I've not really looked at, I've looked at the Mind Flayer in detail, and then I've got like a little bit of detail on two of my other favourite, other than the Bugbear, D&D monsters. But the Demogorgon's like season one, the Mind Flayer season two and three, and then season four, the main villain is
Vecna. Yeah. And there's like Demi Bats as well introduced, but they're sort of like creatures from the other world that he controls. But there is a lot of parallels between Vecna and his character in Stranger Things and the Vecna of Dungeons and Dragons lore.
Yeah. I'd say they are. I mean, obviously they talk about Dungeons and Dragons a lot, so clearly it's an influence on the Duffer Brothers that write it, like their work.
Yeah, the Duffer Brothers.
Obviously, like A lot of 80s stuff is an influence on their work.
Yeah, but at the time when I was reading about Vecna, at the time when they would have been playing Dungeons and Dragons in the timeline of Stranger Things, Vecna's character wasn't fully fleshed out yet. He was just a hand and an eye or body parts at that point. So, but the way they get around that is as a dungeon master, you can just make up your own version of what you think Vecna is.
Yes.
And his own backstory, so... that's kind of how you get around that type of thing. Right, well, what is a Demogorgon? Now, what I found out, I was surprised to see, is that a Demogorgon isn't just a made-up monster. It actually originates from ancient Greece.
Oh.
And it's a deity, or it's probably one of the... I know that he probably was influenced a lot by, like, Gygax was influenced a lot by Lord of the Rings and sci-fi and fantasy and stuff like that, and he was also influenced by mythology, which is probably where you got this Demogorgon from. It's probably one of the few monsters that actually exist in the real world, as in like in mythology and art and stuff. And it's a deity or a demon associated with the underworld. Although it's often ascribed to Greek mythology, the name probably arises from an unknown copyist misreading of a commentary by a 4th century scholar called Lactantius Placidus. And the concept itself can be traced back. Yeah, it's very Latin. And can be traced back to the original misread term demiurge. The origins of the name Demogorgon are not entirely clear, though the most prevalent scholarly view now considered it to be a misreading of the Greek, Demiorgon, accusative case, based on the manuscript variations from the earliest known explicit reference in the Lactantius Placidus, Boccaccio and his influential... See, that's just a lot of nonsense to me. I don't understand what any of this means. It was a Byzantine source. Pronopides the Athenian as authority for the idea that the Demogorgon is the antecedent of all the gods. So the basically the Demogorgon is sort of like an ancient god that precedes all the other gods, that has big powers, that then eventually evolved into the Christianization of the version, where he then went from like a deep kind of old ancient god with mystical, mysterious powers and secrets to a prince of hell, basically. A demon. And I learned that the word demon comes from the Greek word daemon, which just means spirit. But the Christians took that word and turned it into demon. And
yeah.
Well, of course, like they do with everything. So that's basically the Demogorgon was evolved. It was first mentioned in the commentary on Statutus Phoebes, often attributed in manuscripts, so I've said that already, Lactantius Placidus, from 350 to 400 AD. It became the most common medieval commentary on a poem by Statius and is transmitted into most early editions up to 1600. The name Demogorgon is introduced in a discussion of the Phoebade 4.516, which mentions the supreme being of the threefold world. That sounds very Dungeons and Dragons.
It does.
In one manuscript, the author says that the Demogorgon is the supreme god whose name it is not permitted to know, or he is speaking of a god, the supreme Demogorgon. I mean, in Stranger Things and in Dungeons and Dragons, in fact, in Dungeons and Dragons, what is the Demogorgon in terms of Dungeons and Dragons? Let me see. No, that's not it. I was looking at Lich. Demogorgon. Dungeons and Dragons. Here we go. Right. So in the Dungeons and Dragons fantasy role-playing game, the Demogorgon is a powerful demon prince. He's known as the Prince of Demons, a self-proclaimed title, but one that is acknowledged by mortals and even his fellow demons because of his power and influence. The Demogorgon was also named an iconic D&D character and one of the greatest villains in D&D history by the final print issue of Dragon. He's depicted as an 18-foot tall reptilian or amphibious hermaphroditic. and somewhat with a somewhat humanoid form. His torso is depicted as ape-like in accompanying art. Two mandrel or hyena heads sprout from his twin snake-like necks, and his arms end in long tentacles. He has two heads and they have individual minds and names. The Demogorgon first appeared in the original edition of Dungeons and Dragons and Eldritch Wizardry in 1976 and has appeared in every subsequent edition of the game. And in the Netflix show Stranger Things, they just called it that. But in the Stranger Things, the Demogorgon is basically like it's a monster from, and it can evolve as well. Like it sort of spawns by putting slugs inside someone and then they vomit it up, and then it transforms into like Dustin found one and kept it as a pet and called it Dart, short for D'Artagnan, and he fed it, and then it eventually evolved into a demi dog, which is like, it started off like, it evolves into sort of a frog like thing that's like green, and then it evolves into a cat sized thing, and then it evolves into a dog like thing, and then eventually it evolves into its final form, which is like a humanoid with a sort of petal like head that opens up. But I don't think it has its own personality or anything. It's just sort of like mindless, and it's controlled by Vecna or the Mind Flayer, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I'd say that like the two later villains, that they do have sort of similar, as you say, not appearances, but like they do things or are capable of things that are similar to the actual D&D monsters, whereas the Demogorgon seems quite different, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the Demogorgon outside of Dungeons and Dragons is featured in a lot of poems, and sometimes he's a prince of like demons, sometimes he's a god, sometimes he's like a king of the fairy people, like he's often in the fairy world as well, which is weird.
Yeah.
So there's several different types of Demogorgons that are about. In the early Middle Ages, it's the Demogorgon is mentioned in a 10th century series of short notes. Late Middle Ages, the reality of a primordial Demogorgon was fixed in the European imagination, that the Demogorgon's son Pan became a bizarre variant reading for Hermes' son Pan. Which I don't understand what any of that means. he's also mentioned as a primal god in quite a few Renaissance texts, and impressively Gloss Demon Gorgon, Terror Demon, or God of the Earth. The French historian and mythographer. I want to be a mythographers. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that was an actual thing, but there's a guy called John Sesnick, and he determines in the Demogorgon an allusion to the demiurge, craftsman or maker. And it's like a god that makes things or maybe creates things. The Demogorgon was taken up by Christian writers as a demon of hell, because of course Orcus and Aedes. Orcus, is that a Dungeons and Dragons character, Orcus? That rings a bell. In John Milton's Paradise Lost, it says Orcus and Addas and the dreaded name of Demogorgon. I like how the Demogorgon name's just been passed down through different cultures over time and literature, and changed depending on, like, I guess that's kind of a Dungeons and Dragons dungeon master thing. You can change it based on your interpretation. Milton does not refer to the inhabitants of hell, but of an unformed region where chaos rules with night. In Milton's epic poem, Satan passes through this region while travelling from hell to earth. Which I find interesting, because in Stranger Things, the Upside Down is sort of like a between worlds.
Yes.
Isn't it? Like, there's gateways, and if the Demogorgons are coming through the gateways, that's a similar thing to what Milton was saying, that it doesn't actually reside in hell, but it does reside in a strange region between hell and earth. The 16th century Dutch demonologist Johan Weir described the Demogorgon as the master of fate in hell's hierarchy. According to Ariosto's lesser work, Sintikanti, the Demogorgon has a splendid temple palace in the Imavo Mountains, which is in the Himalayas today, where every 5 years the fates and the genii are all summoned to appear before him and give an account of their actions. They travel through the air in various strange conveyances. I don't know what he means by that. Like, whatever. I guess like in, you know, like a vacuum cleaner.
That's, and, I like that you're hitting exactly where my mind was. What's that film even called? Why have I forgotten the name of it? That's terrible. Focus, yeah.
So whatever they can travel on, they'll just travel on that. Like the Scottish witch version would be like traveling on a sieve through the sea and stuff, like weird shit like that. So, and it's no easy matter to distinguish between their convention and a witch's Sabbath. When elements of Ariosto's poem supplied Philippe when else? Libretto. All right, so there's loads of operas and stuff. The Demogorgon was king of the fairies and master of ceremonies in many of these operas. Demogorgon is also mentioned in the book two of the epic poem El Bernardo, written in Mexico by Bernardo de Balbuena, which was published in Spain in 1624. The passage tells how the fairy Alcina visits Demogorgon in his infernal palace. It's all in Mexican, so I can't really translate it. I have no idea what it means. Demogorgon is also mentioned in Edmund Spenser's The Fairy Queen, which was all about Elizabeth I, apparently. A bold, bad man that dared to call by name Great Gorgon, Prince of Darkness and Dead Night, at which coitus quakes and Styx is put to flight. And down in the bottom of the deep abyss, where Demogorgon in dull darkness pent, far from the view of gods in heaven, bless the hideous chaos keeps their dreadful dwellingness. That's again from that poem. The Demogorgon is also the central character in Voltaire's 1756 short story Plato's Dream, a lesser super being who was responsible for creating the planet Earth. He's also the protagonist of another opera called Demogorgon, Demogorgon or the Confused Philosopher. That sounds like a Harry Potter book. it doesn't tell me what the story is, but apparently it was originally written for Mozart. One of the lead characters pretends to be a Demogorgon in a Johann Carl August literary fairy tale, Roland's Napping, which means Roland's Squires. Doesn't really elaborate on the plot either. Apparently he's mentioned in Moby Dick, in the novel Moby Dick. The first mate of the ship, Pequod Starbuck, again, weird name, describes the white whale as the Demogorgon of the ship's heaving crew. Demogorgon also appears as a character in Percy Blythe Shelley's Prometheus Unbound. In this lyrical drama, the Demogorgon is the offspring of Jupiter and Thetis, who eventually dethroned Jupiter. It is never mentioned whether Demogorgon, portrayed as a dark, shapeless spirit, is female or male. The theory of Demogorgon's name, originated from Greek demos and gorgos, may be the foundation for use in this text as an allusion to a politically active and revolutionary populace. Shelley's allusions to the French Revolution further support this. And then finally, in the poem Demogorgon by Alvira de Campos, not Gino de Campos, the writer is afraid of becoming mad by learning the true nature and unveiling the mystery of life. So again, with the Demogorgon, there's a lot of it's like it has a lot of secrets, it holds a lot of secrets, and I think Vecna's a bit like that. He has secrets, but he managed to gain. Well, I'll go over Vecna in a minute, but I'll let you get on with yours, like, which is the Mind Flayer, which is in one of the seasons, the second season of Stranger Things.
Yeah, so it's season 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
So the Mind Flayer in Stranger Things and the Mind Flayer in Dungeons and Dragons look really different, but there are definitely things that kind of link them. Right. So the Mind Flayer in.
What is it in Dungeons and Dragons then?
Dungeons and Dragons is. There's initially like one in the really old version of the game, and then there's like multiple of them. It's kind of like a very, very tall, slender, human shaped creature, but it's got like its head isn't very human at all. It's kind of Cthulhu-y.
Okay.
Like it's got that sort of like raised squiddy head.
Right.
And like really sort of long, sharp talons instead of fingers.
Okay. Does it have big tits?
No, very flat chested.
Aw.
So the Mind Flayer initially appears as a lawful evil aberration, meaning that it's dark and twisted, but it follows its own strict set of rules.
Right.
And it's interesting because it's one of the first creatures in Dungeons and Dragons that was not a natural creature from the world or reality of D&D. It arrives there from another reality. Or it doesn't really arrive there. It's reach extends there from another reality, which is obviously like the Mind Flayer in
Stranger Things,
because it's trapped in the Upside Down, but it has
also
its influence in what's going on in Hawkins.
Yeah, it influences Vecna because it creates Vecna in a way, but Vecna thinks that he's created it. I'll explain that later, but the Mind Flayer has, is either conceived as something that needs to be controlled or created by something else, or it's actually the Puppet Master, so we don't know which is which.
Yes. Like, that's kind of the same in Dungeons and Dragons as well, because it's like nobody knows where it came from, which doesn't really make any sense, because it's in part of Dungeons and Dragons that is their reality, but it's from elsewhere and nobody knows how it got there. So the first Mind Flayer, when it arrived, it appeared in the Underdark, which again is very like the Upside Down. So the Underdark is this idea that sort of there's like the cave systems that run under the main world of Dungeons and Dragons.
Is it called Werf?
Well, no, so that is, but then there's a cave system below that.
Oh my God.
Which is like the like deep down dark caves. Right. And then there's a cave system below that, closer to the center of the earth, which is the Underdark, but it has no accessible passage between the Underdark and any of the above cave systems.
So in a game of Dungeons and Dragons, how would one come across the Mind Flayer? Would it appear randomly or in the story, or does it Dungeon Master decide, or does it depend on what dice you throw and how you defeat it? Does it literally flay minds? Like, how would it affect your character?
That was a lot of questions in the
Sorry,
one question.
I know. I have a lot of questions.
Okay, so when it's first there in the Underdark, it doesn't have any way of accessing the surface world. So in the first like missions that it appeared in, technically it didn't have access to your characters, but it began to like access the minds of thralls in the Middle Dark, which were mostly like small creatures like rats and bats, which again ties in with what's going on in Stranger Things. But then the rats and bats would be able to come up to the cave system above that were like the populated cave systems. And if they came into contact with the creatures there, then that would allow the Mind Flayer to then start to control their minds.
Right, okay.
And then when those creatures either came up into the overworld to trade or meet with other characters, or if your character was to go down into the like cave systems where there are characters living, then that would mean that the Mind Flayer would then have access to your minds, because basically, like, if the little ratty creatures come up and bite one of the cave dwelling people, and then say they come and they like put their hand on top of your hand, if they hold it there long enough,
right,
the Mind Flayer will be able to get a grip on your mind. And then if the Mind Flayer has control of characters' minds, it can influence what they do, it can make them do its bidding, like Billy in Stranger Things.
It
also, like, that's how it feeds. So it derives its energy from, it basically, it has control of your mind and your personality, and it like slowly psychically eats your mind and your personality until you're just like a hollowed out shell.
Part of it was made up of like a green goo, or something, or turned people into green goo in Stranger Things to form that what
also sort of happens. So it's got like so in one of the missions, it's got a thing called a brain golem, where basically it's taking over people's brains, and then as they like liquefies, it feeds on them. It's getting the brain matter to come back down into like the lower cave systems, and it effectively forms them all together into brain golems, which are like huge. It's like the thing in Stranger Things. So huge, like lumbering creatures made of brain matter that it sends up to do its bidding.
I was just funny, my mind went back to Troll 2 when she started going all liquids and then the trolls started eating her. Turning her into vegetables. Anyway, yeah. So, yeah, that's the Mind Flayer. And now we get to Vecna. The link between the Mind Flayer and Vecna is that, such a long backstory. I mean, I'd be like spoiling things for people who didn't see it, but whatever. So I was like, well, let's look at Vecna in terms of Dungeons and Dragons. Vecna is like the main baddie in the last season of Stranger Things, and he's using psychic terror to kill kids to open gates so that he can destroy all of humanity. That's what he wants to do. That's his ultimate goal. But Vecna in Dungeons and Dragons is He is a how do you pronounce this? It's L-I-C-H.
A lich.
A lich.
Yeah.
So he is a lich in Dungeons and Dragons, and he has many names like the Chained God, the Maned God, Master of the Spider Throne, which is interesting because the character that became Vecna in Stranger Things had a sort of fascination and admiration for Black Widow spiders when he was in his human form.
Yeah.
So Vecna is his backstory, because there's loads of stuff here. The backstory was that Vecna was born as a human, as was Vecna in Stranger Things, who was called Henry. Henry Creed, I think that was his name. And centuries ago, as a member, he was an untouchable cast in the Flan city of Fleef on Oer. This might make sense to you, Mark. It doesn't make any sense to me. So he was a member of the untouchable cast in the Flan city.
The Oerth is like the Overearth. So if the...
Right. What's Fleef? That's the city. Okay.
That's the city.
Right. He was initially trained by his mother, who was called Mazel, in the art of magic. It didn't say whether it was good magic or evil magic. But before she was executed, she was then executed by the government of Fleef for practicing witchcraft. So, vowing revenge, Vecna eventually assumed mastery of the dark arts, achieved by no mortal before or since. Some say this achievement was due to direct tutelage by Moxlick, the serpent, believed to be the personification of arcane magic itself. Nearly 1,000 years after his birth, Vecna, now a lich, is that right? A lich, lich, sorry. Now a lich and a ruler of the great and terrible empire and the Sheldamar Valley, centred near modern-day Rushmoors, laid siege to the city of Fleef with an army of arcane spellcasters and undead. Legend has it that Vecna was nearly slain in this battle by clerics channeling the power of Foltis, the god of light. The clerics unleashed a great burst of light which hit Vecna primarily on his left side. Vecna was rescued and brought to safety by one of his wizard generals, what's a cambion?
I don't know.
Okay. Named Aserak or Aserarak or whatever, who would one day himself become a mighty Demolich. Vecna eventually recovered. One on the verge of conquering Fleef, the officials of the city came before him to beg for mercy. They offered up the entire city and her wealth if only Vecna would spare the lives of her citizens. When Vecna was not satisfied, the officials offered their own lives. Vecna gave one of their number, Artau, and his family over to his lieutenant Cass, who's a vampire apparently, who spent the entire day torturing and murdering them before the other officials. Still unsatisfied, Vecna slaughtered all within the city and had their heads stacked before the officials, with those of their family members prominent. Vecna then granted his mercy, granting the officials leave to depart and promising them his protection for the rest of their lives. At his empire's height, Vecna was betrayed and destroyed by his most trusted lieutenant, a vampire called Cass the Bloody Handed, using a magical sword that Vecna himself had crafted for him, now known as the Sword of Cass. Only his left hand and his eye survived the battle. That's how he originally appeared in the first Dungeons & Dragons game, perhaps because of the previous events in Fleef. Vecna did not stay gone forever and rose as a demigod of magic and secrets in the world of Greyhawk. His cult helped set events in motion that would have granted him the power of a greater god, but the plan was ultimately foiled. After these events, Vecna ended up imprisoned in the demiplane of Ravenloft, but broke free again later, emerging with the power of a greater god. After absorbing the power of Lutz, he then broke free into the city of Sigil, where he became perilously close to rearranging all of existence to his whims. Vecna's multiverse-shattering campaign in Sigil is used as an in-universe way to explain the differences between the second and third editions of Dungeons & Dragons. When Vecna was ejected from Sigil by a party of adventurers, Luz was freed and Vecna returned to Oerth greatly just in power, while still a lesser god. And that's basically the story of Vecna.
They still just bobbing about.
So when you're playing Dungeons and Dragons, does Vecna come into it at all? Did you if you heard of Vecna before Stranger Things, like, did you know about his character in the Lich?
No, I knew about other liches. But I've never. But then it sounds like if he was like the main campaign of this end of the second version, that would have been like what? Probably the early 1980s.
Yeah. Second edition was 1989. And the first edition was in 1979. And there was like campaigns called Die Vecna Die. Which is probably what inspired the Stranger Things. So I was like, what the hell is a lich then? So I'm like, well, I need to know what that is. So I looked up lich, and a lich in Dungeons and Dragons is basically a type of undead, and the alignment is any evil. It's like a skeleton with a crown on its head, and it's an undead creature that are spellcasters, and they seek to defy death by magical means. The term derives from lich, an archaic term for corpse. Gary Gygax stated that he based the description of a lich included in the game on the short story The Sword of the Sorcerer by Gardner Fox. I have never really heard of this. I don't really read that kind of sci-fi stuff or fantasy novels. It's not really been my thing. The lich first appears in Monster Manual 1977, where it's given more detailed description, including a brief cryptic note of having reached a non-human, non-living existence through the force of will. It retains this status by certain conjurations, enchantments, and a phylactery, which is basically like Harry Potter's Horcrux, whereby it can basically defy death by putting its soul into an object like a box or a gemstone or some special thing that it keeps guard or has monsters guard. And because if you kill a lich, you can't really kill it because it will just reform back into its body. The only way you can kill a lich is if you get its box or special object and destroy that, because that's where its soul is, like a horcrux basically. So J.K. Rowling probably stole that from that, that kind of thing.
And so to be fair, yeah, that does make sense, because Voldemort is very lichy, isn't he?
Yeah, yes, he does look like a lich, doesn't he? Because he's sort of like a kind of ghoulish looking creature.
Yeah.
So that's basically...
He looks really like one of the editions of the lich, he looks almost the spit of, and then, yeah, you're right, the Horcrux thing is basically the exact same.
You can get good liches, apparently. I don't know why, but... Or they become liches so that they can protect their village or something. So that's why they become liches. There's quite a few different ones they use. Yeah, talking about their magical receptacle. The process of becoming a lich is a ritual of becoming or ceremony of endless night. The process is often described as requiring the creation and consumption of a deadly potion, the elixir of defilation. I want that. Sounds badass. Which is to be drunk on a full moon. Although the exact details of the potion are described differently in various sources, the creation of the potion almost universally entails acts of utter evil, such as using a ingredient of the blood of an infant slain by the potential lich's own hand, or other similarly vile components. The potion invariably kills the drinker. If the process is successful, it rises again some days later as an undead lich. Occasionally, this metamorphosis occurs by accident as a result of life-prolonging magic. Okay. Unlike most other forms of undead creatures, the lich retains all of the memories, personality, and abilities that it possessed in life, but has virtual eternity to hone its skills and inevitably becomes very powerful. Like other powerful forms of the undead, such as vampires or mummies, a lich has unnatural powers owing to its state. For example, it can put mortals... Now, this is very Stranger Things, because it can put mortals in a paralyzed state of hibernation with their minds, making them seem dead to others. And it can, through its typically powerful magical spells, summon other lesser undead to protect it, such as the Demogorgon, Demi Bats, and I suppose in Stranger Things, the Vecna and that can use its psychic powers to, like, raise kids in the air, and then yes. he uses that, like, to paralyze them with fear, and then he breaks her bones and implodes her heads to create the unlock the gates, which is what he does. But anyway, that's basically the Vecna from the game Dungeons and Dragons. But in Stranger Things, he is, oh my god, there's such a huge backstory, right? But basically, Vecna is a fearsome entity aligned with the Upside Down, and he has humble origins, as in the one in Dungeons and Dragons, as a human Henry Creel. In childhood, Henry experienced a traumatic incident involving stolen government technology and a shadowy entity. The shadowy entity is the Mind Flayer. So even as he encountered the Mind Flayer first as a child, and he claimed that the reason he killed his family was because the Mind Flayer gave him the powers to do so and told him to. Although the other side of it is that he was just evil and he wanted to kill them, and he's just blaming it on the Mind Flayer, so I don't know which is true and which isn't. Or whose story is, like, the correct one.
But then the Mind Flayer in Dungeons and Dragons, mm-hmm. again, will use, like, its reach to go into the actual right. world itself and try and take over people's minds, so it could be both. Like, if you're already mm-hmm. evil and you already have a weak mind, it's going to be easier for it to take you over.
Right, okay, so he's seen that Henry was a weak-minded person and easy to take over and manipulate?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Henry brought he drew the interest of a Dr. Martin Brenner, who took Henry to Hawkins National Laboratory to be studied. He was designated number one, becoming the laboratory's first child test subject. But because he was deemed too powerful or something, the doctor implanted a Soteria into Henry's neck, which was a miniature device that suppressed his powers and apparently tracked his movements. In Henry's own words, he'd become a prisoner in time. Eventually, Henry grew up to be like the one of the orderlies who looked after the other kids that they experimented on. But he seen that Eleven was being bullied, and he seen himself in Eleven and said, oh, she's like me. But then he manipulated her into taking the device out of his neck so that he then killed everyone in the laboratory and revealed himself as being number one Henry. And then Eleven fought him and opened the gate and pushed him into the other world. And the reason he transformed into Vecna, this horrific kind of looking Freddy Krueger type cunt, is because he was trapped in the other world and lightning kept hitting him. So he eventually mutated into what he looks like now. But also it was the Mind Flayer that sort of did that to him as well. So he developed like natural traits of that world, like with his vine like organic kind of nature, like he tentacles and things. And the Mind Flayer was just like a dark shadowy mist, but he used his psychic kinetic powers to turn it into what he liked when his childhood, which was a Black Widow spider. So he turned it into sort of like a spider like thing, and then used the Mind Flayer to connect him to the earth realm. As in, like, in season 2 and 3, I think.
Yeah.
When he used it to take over Billy and stuff like that. He wants to get back to Earth, so his ultimate goal is to destroy all humanity out of revenge, because he feels like they're just weak and inferior to him. So, there we go. That's where Vecna comes from. I mean, I could talk more and more about him, but, like, I don't know. I just feel like I'd just be describing the entire season of Stranger Things. So yeah, he sent an army of adolescent demogorgons to attack the Hawkins lab before going on to possess a large group of humans and using their flesh to create a gigantic spider-like monster in the image of the Mind Flayer. In both instances, Eleven and her allies ultimately thwarted Vecna's plans by closing the gates to the Upside Down. So everything that happens basically in Stranger Things is all down to Vecna.
Yes.
Or Henry.
Or sort of the Mind Flayer. Because again, if it was influencing him, then...
Well, they said that the Mind Flayer... Well, Henry tried to take over and control the Mind Flayer, but the Mind Flayer didn't like that, so it started punishing Henry or like doing things to him to stop him. But I don't know who wins in that battle ultimately. Anyway, at the end of the last season, they do get him, but I think he gets shot by a shotgun. Like, he's hidden away in the sort of his old family home in his own sort of mind world, which is in the Upside Down. But he's vulnerable because he's connected to all these vines that I don't know, he uses to harness his power. But while he's in that meditative state, he's sort of vulnerable. So they go into the the Upside Down to trap him while he's using his psychic powers to fight Eleven. So they do injure him, they set him on fire, but he's not dead, so he's out there somewhere, but we just don't know what. So we need to wait till the next season to find out what happens.
Yeah, to find out what happens.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really it. I don't know what else I can say. I mean, there is obviously, like, in Stranger Things, they touch on the satanic panic thing, because Eddie gets basically blamed for the deaths of some vulnerable teenagers that Vecna basically targets, because he targets vulnerable people who are, like, much like the Mind Flayer does.
Yes.
Is targeting him, because he's got a vulnerable, like, torturous family background or whatever, psychologically. He does the same thing to those kids. So is it the Mind Flayer telling him to do that, or is it him that's figured that out from the Mind Flayer to get access to get the Upside Down into the real world or our dimension? I don't know what his ultimate goal is other than to destroy all of humanity, but then what does he do after that? Just rule as the king of... I don't know. Like, what's the point? Like,
there's a mind, or a group of Mind Flayers that arrive in one of the seasons of Dungeons and Dragons that are called the Illithids, and they take over the minds of people on the surface to get them to basically start to bore down into the underworld so that they can escape. And then when they do, their entire plan is to take over everyone on the entire planet's mind, so that they can bring perfect order to the planet, but that means, like, basically making it into a hellscape, which seems kind of like what was happening at the end of the last season of Stranger Things.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, ultimately, I think it's the Mind Flayer's plan rather than Vecna's plan.
Yes.
I feel like the Mind Flayer is just using Vecna.
Yeah, like, Vecna, he thinks he's in charge of everything, but...
Yeah, but he's not. The Mind Flayer is. Because he's been manipulating the Mind Flayer. I'm giving it a gender. The Mind Flayer is has been manipulating Henry to the point, like, all along, way back when he was a child, to achieve this goal, I think.
Yeah.
But maybe knowing that it's, like, that Henry's, it may even gave him, like, the powers that he needed to fight potentially any other people who might come up against him in the future. So... But yeah, that's my theory on it, based on what I've learned from Dungeons and Dragons.
I think that's
what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that it's going to turn out that the Mind Flayer's like using him as a way to get through to the real world.
Yeah, but giving him a purpose, as in I want to destroy all humanity, get revenge. But ultimately, it is the shadow thing that he calls the Mind Flayer that in charge, and that is ultimately in control. He is not the puppet master, the Mind Flayer is.
Yes.
He just wants to make him think he is the puppet master himself, but he's not. The old switcheroo or whatever. I don't know. I'm not a Duffer Brother, but I think that's how it's going to go down.
I'm more so laughing because I imagine there that at the end of Stranger Things, the Mind Flayer will just open its eyes to that point, an invisible mouth, and be like, I did the old switcheroo. And then that'll be the end of the piece.
Yay! and then it cuts to Mark as the Dungeon Master, and he's just made the whole thing up. I bet
that would be an excellent end to
and Stranger very Things. Surprising to you. Because like,
to be fair, of all people, I'd be most blown away by that.
Imagine that, like, your life was just one big game of Dungeons and Dragons, and all of their life so far has just been one part of that story. And then you get to the end of it and you realise that it was all just a game. How would you feel?
I wouldn't feel anything because I'd cease to exist. But if I could feel anything, probably be a bit pissed off. Imagine that we are just somebody else's dungeon. Imagine there's a real medieval fantasy world and we're their fantasy world of just having boring lives.
A sort of Dungeons and Dragons Matrix style.
Yeah.
As you will, if you will. We're all just some nerd's story in his basement. And then when he finally ends the story, that's when we die.
It would be, again, we wouldn't exist anymore, but if I was able to be annoyed about that, I'd be quite annoyed.
Unless we respawn and become a new character, that's reincarnation.
That would be cool.
I'm starting a whole new religion, Mark, based on Dungeons and Dragons. The Christians were right. We are right. Oh, Donald Trump's a demigorgon. I don't know what he is.
He does seem to be a reanimated corpse covered in evil magic, so.
Maybe. Rishi Sunak's definitely the ultimate evil. Or is it the royal family? I don't know. They seem irrelevant now anyway, so I don't know what characters they would be. What are kind of the prophetic things in Dungeons and Dragons that don't really have much power, but are in the evil category?
That is a good question.
Are there lizard people?
There are lizard people.
Okay.
But lizard people aren't necessarily evil.
Oh, okay. What's the stupidest monster that you know of in the Dungeons and Dragons monster list?
Gelatinous cubes don't have brains and are just made for destruction. The royal family can be them.
Okay. But is that taken from H.P. Lovecraft?
Like quite a lot of the monsters, as you say, are inspired by mythology and then also
Eldritch
by
waters.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
In fact, the Mind Flayers are not from mythology. They're inspired by the Titus Crowe series, which is not written by Lovecraft, but is part of the expanded Lovecraft mythos. So there's a creature in that that's...
I'm going to have to start reading Lovecraft.
You really should.
Okay. Yeah. What am I reading now? I just finished reading Mimi Van Doren's biography.
Cool.
Playing the Field. It's got nothing to do with what we were talking about, but yeah, it was quite good. Oh, no, I haven't finished it yet, but I'm about to finish it. I'm near the end of it. And then after that, I think, what shall I read? I've got David Lynch's biography. I might just read that one. Yeah, cool.
I imagine that would be fascinating.
I think it will. But do you know what? They said they were going to reboot the Twin Peaks with Robert Eggers as director. I'm like, please don't fucking do that. Just don't. No. Just leave it alone. Do not reboot or do your own version of Twin Peaks. David Lynch would be livid. I mean, what can he do? How can he not? Can he not stop that? Does he not have the rights? Why would they do that? Stop it! I'm so upset. No one else can play
Vancouver, but
Kyle MacLachlan. Anyhow, so he popped up in Fallout. I don't know if you ever played that computer game. I played it quite a bit. I gave up on it, but then I went back to it, and I quite enjoyed it. And they've made a TV show out of it. And it's on Prime, and I actually love it. It's brilliant. It's so much like the game. It's amazing. Matt Berry's in it as well, so that's also a plus. And Kyle MacLachlan is in that, or Agent Coop, as I like to call him, because he always will be. And he's one of the Vault Dwellers, but he's not in it for long, but I won't spoil it for you. I definitely think you should watch it. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. And Walton Goggins is in it, and he's great. You don't know who he is, but whatever.
No, I do. I do know who Walker Goggins
is. Baby Billy and the Righteous... You ever watch The Righteous Gemstones?
I've not, no.
Oh, you've got to watch that. You'd love it. It's like a piss take of all the big, rich, evangelical preachers in America. And it's like John Goodman plays like the father figure of the Gemstones, and then you've got like the youth pastor who's like got his friend who's a former Satanist, but they're really gay. and then there's the sister who's like a complete psycho, and is there another? Oh yeah, and then there's Danny McBride who plays the eldest brother, and he's like just this mental kind of rich boy, spoiled boy, and he's got two sons, and one of the sons wants to be like a stuntman, so he gets like booted out the family. It's just a whole big piss take of like big evangelical people that have got too much money and how much money they make and how corrupt they are, and they're not that religious. Do you know what I mean?
That does sound
and Walton like, Goggins
particularly entertaining, yeah, for me.
Walton Goggins plays this sort of like John Goodman's wife has her brother, and her used to have like a little like kids like singing Christian group, and he was called Baby Billy, but he's like all grown up and he's just like never really changed, grown out of his Baby Billy persona, and he's just trying to ride on those kind of coattails, and he's got like a really young wife, and he's just funny. Anyway, Walton Goggins is in Fallout and he plays like a sort of cowboy star from the 50s that somehow survived the nuclear apocalypse, but this has turned into something called a ghoul, so he's got no nose, but he's like a skeletal guy that's still a cowboy. Anyway, Fallout is quite good. I'd recommend it. The dog in Fallout games is called Dog Meat. it's an Alsatian, and that it's one of your companions, or you can have like a robot as your companion as well, which I suspect is played by Matt Berry in this series, but not in the games. I don't know who voices him in the games. He does sound like a bit like Stephen Fry, so it might be him or someone like that. It's an English accent, anyway. But, well, that's the end of that, then. I can't really think of anything more to say. I mean, there's probably shitloads of, like, there's obviously, like, loads of monsters and Dungeons and Dragons. Uh-huh.
We could, in theory, talk about Dungeons and Dragons forever and ever and ever.
yeah, we could. Because there's so many different monsters and classes and stories and evil characters. Obviously, you'd know more than me. Maybe I should just try and play it one day, but I just don't know that many people who play it who would invite me along to play. So
yeah, and it doesn't really work unless you have, like, I'd say three or more people playing as well as the Dungeon Master.
And meet up regularly to play it, I guess. Like, I'd feel like just a bit of an intruder. All right, well, let's pick a new topic from, what is it now? 1 to 40-something?
44.
What would Vecna pick? He would pick number 12.
He probably would, because it's more unsolved murders, and I bet Vecna is responsible for many an unsolved murder.
Yay! Unsolved murders is one of my favourite topics, so yeah, I'm looking forward to looking into that.
I do like when we do a wee unsolved murder.
Yeah, definitely. Or even just unsolved, maybe disappearances and things. Unsolved murders, there's so many of them, and it's just such a fascinating topic. So we'll do that.
Yay!
Okay, well, I don't really know how we end this podcast. You end it?
Everyone listening, roll a six-sided dice. If you roll an odd number, you get a hat, and if you roll an even number, you get a potato. Good night.
Good night. Bye.